I'm Lorena Allam and welcome to Hindsight, and the first in our monthly series to commemorate the centenary of World War I, The Long Shadow, 100 years since the Great War. Today, a book about World War I that may have helped to save the world from nuclear catastrophe. In 1962, American historian Barbara Tuchman published The Guns of August, a history of the first month of World War I and the diplomatic chaos which preceded it, the July Crisis, when events took on a momentum of their own and nations found themselves at war as if by accident. In 1962, there were lessons here for the belligerents of a new era, the Cold War. They were lessons that President Kennedy took to heart. Deeply disturbed by the idea of nations sliding accidentally into war, Kennedy had the book distributed to key members of his administration. What was it in Tuchman's book about World War I that spoke to the anxieties of the Cold War era? And what were the lessons that Kennedy took from it that enabled him to stop a nuclear catastrophe? The Guns of August is produced by Gary Bryson.
So gorgeous was the spectacle on the May morning of 1910, when nine kings rode in the funeral of Edward VII of England, that the crowd, waiting in hushed and black-clad awe, could not keep back gasps of admiration. In scarlet and blue and green and purple, three by three the sovereigns rode through the palace gates, with plumed helmets, gold braid, crimson sashes, and jeweled orders flashing in the sun. After them came five heirs apparent, 40 more imperial or royal highnesses, 7 queens, 4 dowager, and 3 regent, and a scattering of special ambassadors from uncrowned countries. Together they represented 70 nations in the greatest assemblage of royalty and rank ever gathered in one place, and, of its kind, the last. The muffled tongue of Big Ben tolled 9 by the clock as the cortege left the palace. But on history's clock it was sunset, and the sun of the old world was setting in a dying blaze of splendor, never to be seen again.
I first read The Guns of August, I think, in 1963. It came out in 1962, and I just started as a young history student at the University of Toronto, and a friend said, you should read this book, it's terrific, and I read it, and I thought it was absolutely wonderful. And I think what I loved about her, and I loved about the book, was the way in which she described things, she brought history to life. She had what I later discovered, what she called the corroborative detail. She had this knack for finding a detail that would just bring a situation or a person or a place alive. And it just was a revelation to me. I had always loved history, but I hadn't read many history books that were just so readable.
Barbara Tuchman's book, which I read when I was in secondary school, before I even went to university in the United States, because it came out in 1962 when I was 15 years old, it's gripping. It's a marvelous story. Barbara Tuchman writes the way every historian wishes that he or she would be able to write.
I read Tuchman's book a long time ago, and I thought it's brilliant narrative, wonderful depiction of characters, and it gave a sense of the world spinning out of control and the political leaders not really being able to do very much about it, lacking the broader vision and also the ability to control these events which had taken on a momentum of their own.
When she wrote The Guns of August in 1962, historian Barbara Tuchman had only 2 previous books to her credit. The Guns of August was a huge success, surprising her and delighting a new generation of historians. It tells the story of the first month of World War I, and of the diplomatic crisis which preceded it. How events can spiral out of control. How human failings can affect crucial decisions. How military plans can take on their own unstoppable imperative. Margaret McMillan is Professor of History at St. Anthony's College, Oxford.
We were all getting to realize by 1962 that there was this very unstable balance between the United States and the Soviet Union, which was really kept by the threat of nuclear weapons. And by 62, both sides had the capacity, which was going to increase, to deliver serious nuclear damage to the other side. I mean, the launching of the Soviet Sputnik brought intercontinental ballistic missiles onto the scene. And so I think we were beginning to realize just how vulnerable both sides could be. And I think we were also beginning to realize that there was a real danger in events simply taking over, that you would suddenly get a situation where they began to escalate. I mean, there was a whole sort of ladder, it was called, of escalation. One step was meant to follow another. And I think we were beginning to realize that there might be the danger of a sort of doomsday machine that would begin to just move, and it would be very, very difficult to stop. And I think Barbara Tuchman's analysis of the outbreak of the First World War was both affected by that and also fed into that fear. She placed a great deal of emphasis on the rigid military timetables and argued that the military had got such rigid timetables involving mass mobilizations and the movement of troops along railways that it became very difficult to stop once it had been set in motion. And I think that was a fear we had in the early 1960s about the Cold War.
Catastrophic events spiraling out of control. The July crisis of 1914 was set in motion by the assassination in Sarajevo of the Austrian heir to the throne, Archduke Franz Ferdinand. British Prime Minister Lloyd George described the sequence of events which followed as nations sliding into war, an accident. It's an idea that took fertile root in the teaching of World War I history. Anthony D'Agostino is Professor of History at San Francisco State University.
That's the way I was taught in school. The crisis of 1914 came up very suddenly. There were miscalculations. The powers couldn't decide whether to be in or out, and a great deal of confusion. And all of this was directed against the war guilt clause of the Treaty of Versailles in 1919, which said that Germany and her allies were solely responsible for having caused the war. And so there was a historical literature that developed in the 1920s about that. And that's what affected me when I was first studying this whole issue. The war guilt clause said Germany was entirely responsible. The revisionist literature was mostly sponsored by the Germans. They had a whole office in their foreign ministry devoted to support for scholarly projects that had to do with the origins of World War I. So the scholars all pitched into that. Most of them had support one way or another from the German government. And they arrived at the very complex description of the events of 1914, which indicates that, well, the Germans were partially at fault, but there were great miscalculations. The Austrians were a little bit more at fault, but there were great miscalculations. The French also had a role. The Russians had a role. So that when I was studying the thing in the 1960s from one of the leading diplomatic historians who'd actually played a role in all of this controversy back in the 1930s, he presented it to us as an accident.
That is very much, if you like, the traditional view, one that arose in the 1920s and 1930s, which was perpetuated in the memoirs of various diplomats and politicians who were around in 1914.
Thomas Otte, Professor of Diplomatic History at the University of East Anglia.
It seems to me that the war was not entirely accidental. It did not come entirely out of the blue. Of course, there were circumstances and factors that made war perhaps more likely. But there had been lots of crises involving the great powers in the years before 1914, and all of these got resolved in one form or another. Not everyone was happy always with the outcome, but peace was preserved and some sort of settlement was arrived at. So why was it that in 1914 this didn't work? What was different about 1914? I think that is the important question here. Having said that it was not entirely an accident, I would nevertheless say it was inadvertent, or that there are strong aspects of inadvertency in this. None of the leaders of the various European countries wanted war, with one exception, that is Austria-Hungary. But what matters here is that the combination of the individual calculations and the individual manoeuvres helped to escalate the crisis, and eventually it moved it beyond the reach of mediation and moderation. And that, I think, is the important dynamic in July 1914. This is not a case of the power simply slithering over the brink into war or sleepwalking into a European catastrophe. But one needs to look at how each of the powers viewed the situation, how the decision makers in the various capitals calculated their interests, how they perceived the other powers as acting, and how those calculations that shaped their policy decisions affected the decisions of the other powers. One really has to look at who knew what, when did they know it, and on what basis did they make their decisions. You know, countries do not act in the abstract. It's not Austria-Hungary that does something. It's Count Berchtold, the foreign minister. He has to get the Hungarian prime minister, Count Tisza, on site. The emperor plays a role. The chief of the general staff plays a very important role in Austro-Hungarian decision-making in the July crisis. So one needs to look at their motivations. And then the picture becomes much more complex, and one gets a much better sense, really, of this evolving dynamic that the politicians in the end struggle to control.
It was one of Barbara Tuchman's great strengths to bring historical characters vividly to life and to remind us that wars are made by real people, with all their foibles, their strengths and weaknesses. How much was this a factor in the decision-making of the July crisis of 1914? Margaret Macmillan.
There's certain points in history, particularly in international history, where who's in charge matters. And I think in the summer of 1914, it really mattered that in Russia you had a man who was very weak, a czar who was not up to the job of controlling what was a very big and complicated and difficult country, and who eventually gave way to his generals and to the hawks in his own government. And in Germany, of course, you had this wildly erratic figure of the Kaiser, who talked in a blustering way, sounded belligerent, but who in fact probably, and certainly most of his actions showed this, would have preferred peace, but was not prepared to stand up to the military. And in the end, when he was pressured to order a general mobilization, which meant Germany would be essentially at war with both Russia and France, he resisted briefly, and then he was in bed at night, and he just turned over and said, do what you want. That was a real failure of leadership.
The Kaiser was livid about regicide. He felt that something absolutely had to be done. However, you know, he changed. Within a couple of weeks, he changed his mind entirely about the issue of regicide. The Serbians did not need to be brought to account because of the assassination of the Archduke Franz Ferdinand. Everything had been settled by the Serbian acceptance. They accepted about 98% of the Austrian ultimatum that was issued them. And then the Kaiser said he was satisfied. So this is typical of the Kaiser, you know, very excited at one point and ready to go to the mat with his opponents and then rethinking it and turning in 180 degrees in the opposite direction.
And of course, in Austria-Hungary, you had the great irony that the man who would have stood up to the generals because he'd stood up to them on previous occasions had just been assassinated at Sarajevo. And the Archduke Franz Ferdinand had resisted the endless pleas from the chief of the general Austrian general staff to go to war in previous crises. Of course, he was now dead. And the man who was left in charge, the old emperor, Franz Joseph, was old. He had very few people around him to advise him. And his health was not good. And I think he just gave way to the hawks. And so I think it was a fatal conjunction for Europe that at a time when you needed cool heads and strong leadership in three key countries, you didn't have it.
There comes a point in the July crisis when the calculation was made that perhaps the risks of a war were preferable to the certainty of a diplomatic defeat. But that is very late in the crisis. It is not at the beginning of the crisis. So the calculations change in this crisis. But it seems quite clear from the sources that, with the exception of the leadership of Austria-Hungary, no one really wanted this war.
Thomas Otte. No one may have wanted war, but military leaders in all the major European countries have been planning for one for some time. Like Germany's Count Alfred von Schlieffen.
Count Alfred von Schlieffen, chief of the German General Staff from 1891 to 1906, was, like all German officers, schooled in Clausewitz's precept. The heart of France lies between Brussels and Paris. It was a frustrating axiom because the path it pointed to was forbidden by Belgium neutrality. which Germany, along with the other four major European powers, had guaranteed in perpetuity. Believing that war was a certainty and that Germany must enter it under conditions that gave her the most promise of success, Schlieffen determined not to allow the Belgian difficulty to stand in Germany's way. Of the two classes of Prussian officer, the bull-necked and the wasp-waisted, he belonged to the second. Monocled and effete in appearance, cold and distant in manner, he concentrated with such single-mindedness on his profession that when an aide, at the end of an all-night staff ride in East Prussia, pointed out to him the beauty of the River Pragel sparkling in the rising sun, the general gave a brief, hard look and replied, "An unimportant obstacle." So, too, he decided, was Belgium neutrality.
Well, Schlieffen was a sort of guru of the German General Staff. The German General Staff was an extraordinary institution which was copied all over the world, in fact, because it was seen as being so effective. And it was the planning brains of the German army. And it often attracted very clever and very ambitious men. And increasingly, it came to occupy a dominant role in German war thinking, and indeed, increasingly, in German military command.
Schlieffen was the architect of the plan that would see Germany attack France and Russia simultaneously on two fronts. He died in 1913, but his modified plan lived on. It was carried out in August 1914 by his successor, Helmut von Moltke.
Von Moltke was one of these people who had inherited a family name, a bit like Napoleon III, who had to try and live up to the great Napoleon. You had von Moltke, who had an uncle who had been a military genius, who had presided over the wars of German unification and had built up this extraordinary general staff. And I think von Moltke, the nephew, always had a sneaking feeling that he wasn't up to his uncle. And I think this was probably the case. He was easily rattled. He tended to be very pessimistic. And in 1914, his health was not good. In fact, when the crisis began to develop, he was off at a spa trying to get his health back into shape. And it's suspected that he had some sort of nervous breakdown in the final days of the crisis when the Kaiser, at the last moment, began to try and pull back from the brink and said, "Oh, look, can't we just fight Russia, not fight France and Russia?" And von Moltke apparently went red in the face and looked absolutely dreadful. And his wife said something seems to have snapped in him then. He was relieved from his post, in fact, in September 1914. And so I think he was someone who was under terrific pressure and perhaps not up to it. He was later on criticized after the war by German generals who said it was all his fault that they lost, that the Schlieffen plan had been brilliant, and if von Moltke hadn't fiddled with it, it would have been okay. But I think that's absolute nonsense. I think von Moltke did the best he could. But essentially, Germany's plans were very, very risky because they were plans to fight a two-front war, and also the movement into Belgium to get at France meant violating the neutrality of Belgium, which Germany, among other European powers, had guaranteed. And that made it much more certain that Britain would enter the war, which brought in, of course, not just Britain, but the whole of the British Empire against Germany.
The threat of bringing Britain in, that would be the main problem there, not the problem of the violation of Belgian neutrality, which would be a secondary matter in an issue involving all of the greatest powers. But the argument that was put up in response was that even if the British do come in defense of Belgium, they can't do much for at least 6 months, or perhaps not at all. By that time, the Germans would have got a decision.
Anthony D'Agostino. In the complexity of the military planning of 1914, Barbara Tuchman saw a system that took on a life of its own.
War pressed against every frontier. Suddenly dismayed, governments struggled and twisted to fend it off. It was no use. Agents at frontiers were reporting every cavalry patrol as a deployment to beat the mobilization gun. General staffs, goaded by their relentless timetables, were pounding the table for the signal to move, lest their opponents gain an hour's head start. Appalled upon the brink, the chiefs of state who would be ultimately responsible for their country's fate attempted to back away, but the pull of military schedules dragged them forward.
In all European countries, the military had planned for war. They'd planned a series of offensive plans. I mean, that was their job. But it's the job of the civilians to decide whether or not to go to war. And in certain countries, I would say Austria, Hungary, Russia, and Germany in particular, the military had made plans and the civilians had not acquainted themselves with those plans sufficiently. I think there was a real failure on the part of civilian government. And so what you got in Germany in particular, and also in Russia, you got the military saying, we have to move now. We have to put the plans into operation. I mean, the German fear was that if they delayed, the Russians would begin to mobilize. Russian mobilization took longer. And so if Germany waited, the Russians would be able to mobilize and perhaps get a head start on Germany. And the German military kept on saying to their government, we have to mobilize because the danger is getting greater and greater. And in all countries, the military used the argument that if we don't mobilize, every day's delay in mobilization is so many kilometers of land lost. No one ever challenged that. It's not at all clear that that would have happened. But there was this sort of panicky pressure from the military that we have to get our plans into operation. We have to do it now before the other side gets a jump on us. Because if we don't start mobilizing now, the other side will be ready. They'll have their troops at the frontier. We'll still be scurrying around in something of a mess and we'll be an easy target to defeat, which I think was a real exaggeration. And I think the civilians should have challenged it.
But nothing could stop the relentless urge to war. On August 1st, 1914, following the Schlieffen Plan and expecting a quick victory, Germany declared war on Russia. And on August the 3rd, on France. The next day, they invaded Belgium.
The month of August 1914 was a month in which it began to become clear that the First World War, the Great War, of course, as they called it then, was going to involve casualties on a scale that they hadn't really contemplated. I mean, some of the worst losses, in fact, were going to be in the first months of the war. And what also became clear is that if neither side had a quick victory, then there was probably going to be a sort of stalemate. The German plan, the Schlieffen Plan, essentially was to fight a holding action in the east against Russia, which was allied to France, and put the bulk of its forces into a great sweeping movement, which would come down through Belgium into the north of France, and then probably encircle Paris, at which point the Germans assumed the French would simply surrender. Now, it was a plan that was very beautiful in many ways, but like all plans, it had defects. And I think one of the defects was that it didn't take into account what that great military thinker, also a German, von Clausewitz, said, and that as soon as you begin to put military plans into action, you begin to get grit in the works, you begin to get things that will go wrong. And the German plan began to slow up. They hadn't counted on Belgian resistance, for example. They hadn't counted on the British Expeditionary Force coming in. And by the time they reached close to Paris, their lines were already very seriously extended, their troops were exhausted, they were beginning to have trouble with supplies, and the speed of the advance was slowing down. And the French pulled themselves together and switched troops very hastily to the front against the Germans. And the First Battle of the Marne was absolutely crucial. What happened is the Germans, or the German Chief of Staff von Moltke, decided to withdraw north, as he thought, temporarily, regroup and then renew the attack. But in fact, the withdrawal turned into a slow movement back towards the north of France and the Belgian borders. And then, of course, by around November, December, the Germans began to dig in. They thought just for the winter. The Allies began to dig in. They thought just for the winter. But that's really, at that point, it becomes clear that a stalemate has developed. I think the problem with the German plan is it was probably unworkable. It's not clear they had enough troops to make it happen. And it counted too much on everything going like clockwork. I don't know what you call it in Australia, but here in North America, we call it Murphy's Law. Anything that can go wrong will.
They were all prepared for this short war, and they knew it would be terrible and bloody. There'd be nasty battles. They might lose thousands, tens of thousands. But in the end, someone would crack, and they'd get a decision. And then they'd have a peace conference, and then everything would be settled. There'd be compensations. All of the 19th century accoutrements of diplomacy would be employed. The difference between the short war and the short war that they expected and the long war that they got, that's the whole difference.
The deadlock, fixed by the failures of the first month, determined the future of the war and, as a result, the terms of the peace, the shape of the interwar period, and the conditions of the second round.
I don't think 1 month produces all those consequences, but I think what August does is make a quick victory on the part of Germany impossible, and so does open the door to this long, long war of attrition. And as it was, the war stopped at a point when Germany could feel that it hadn't really been defeated, although it was defeated on the battlefield. The German public, by and large, didn't see an occupying army, and I think were able to feel that they had made peace in an honorable fashion and that really nobody had won and nobody had lost. And that certainly fed in to German hatred of the Treaty of Versailles, of the attempts by Germans across the political spectrum to evade its terms, and also by the attacks on it by the ultra-right, Hitler, of course, in particular. But I think many other things contributed both to the failure of the peace after 1918 and indeed the outbreak of the Second World War. And I don't think we can trace it all back to the failure of the Schlieffen Plan in August 1914. But it's a very good argument, and I think a very interesting one.
When at last it was over, the war had many diverse results and one dominant one transcending all others. Disillusion. All the great words were cancelled out for that generation, wrote D.H. Lawrence, in simple summary for his contemporaries. If any of them remembered, with a twinge of pain like Emile Verheeren, the man I used to be, it was because he knew the great words and beliefs of the time before 1914 could never be restored.
You're listening to Hindsight on RN and The Guns of August, how a book about the beginning of World War I helped avert a nuclear crisis nearly 50 years later.
Do you, Ambassador Zorin, deny that the USSR has placed and is placing medium and intermediate range missiles and sites in Cuba?
A putting green from 40,000 feet. Literally thousands of pictures can be made on each flight.
Within the past week, unmistakable evidence has established the fact that a series of offensive missile sites is now in preparation on that imprisoned island.
These specialists. Suddenly the veil is torn from the Russian secrets.
Конец! Могила! Колониальному рабству! Долой его! И похоронить его чем глубже, тем лучше!
The Cuban Missile Crisis for me was a personal event. I was very young at the time. My father was in the Naval Reserves, had heard about it, and he knew that this was going to be bad. And it wasn't really actually in the press yet, but he took me down to my basement, our basement in Indiana, and he said, this is going to be our bomb shelter, and you're going to be the man of the house because I might have to leave. And there's bottled water, you know, tin cans of food, and this ridiculous roof over this corner where there are no windows. So I got really interested in the Cuban Missile Crisis early on.
In October of 1962, an American spy plane spotted Soviet nuclear missiles being deployed in Cuba, threatening the US mainland. What followed were 13 days of diplomatic and military tension, which took the world to the very brink of all-out nuclear war. James Dedarian is Michael Hint's Chair of International Security Studies and Director of the Centre for International Security Studies at the University of Sydney.
We truly did come to the precipice. It made me realize just how circumstance, luck, good leadership, but also goodwill can bring you back from the precipice. And those are subjective qualities. You know, all these people think that you can rationally plan foreign policy and treat international relations as sort of a rational choice model that the economists would use. It's going to lead to disaster because there's always these intersubjective elements. And so the Cuban Missile Crisis is an example of bureaucratic interest fighting it out to be top dog. And people look at the geopolitical realist school where it's all about maximizing your self-interest. But there's also people who weren't corresponding to these models. They were thinking about, if I make the wrong move now, it's not tens of millions of people like died in the First World War, but hundreds of millions of people, and in a period of months, not over 4 years. And that weighed heavily on, I think, most of the people in those rooms making decisions in both the Soviet Union and in Washington, D.C.
Cuba had been a crisis that had been gathering for several years, and a couple of years before, Kennedy had faced a tremendous defeat at the Bay of Pigs when a U.S.-sponsored invasion of Cuban exiles landed on the beaches of northern Cuba and were pretty much wiped out by Castro's forces.
Michael Dobbs is a journalist and Cold War historian, author of 1 Minute to Midnight, Kennedy, Khrushchev and Castro on the Brink of Nuclear War.
Kennedy saw Cuba within the context of a global East-West ideological confrontation with the Soviet Union. Castro had just declared Cuba to be a socialist state, and previously it had been very much part of the American sphere of influence. So when Kennedy was told that Khrushchev had put missiles in America's backyard in the Caribbean, he saw that both as a personal affront to him, because Khrushchev had earlier promised him that he would do no such thing, and as undermining America's credibility. So he was therefore committed to doing something about it.
As in 1914, human foibles played their part in the escalating crisis.
Kennedy was much younger than Khrushchev. Khrushchev was a seasoned politician. He had been through the Second World War, and as he put it, Kennedy was young enough to be his son. They'd met once in Vienna, and Khrushchev had behaved in a rather boorish, threatening fashion. He seemed to be rather cavalier talking about nuclear weapons. Khrushchev was a real sort of human being, a personality, but Kennedy thought he was unpredictable. We're not quite sure about how Khrushchev saw Kennedy at the Vienna summit, but certainly Kennedy thought that he had made a very bad impression on Khrushchev. He thought that Khrushchev thought he was weak. And for that reason, Kennedy told his advisers that I have to correct that misimpression. And so when he was challenged in Cuba, Kennedy thought it very important to show that he could stand up to the Soviet leader who had been pushing him around.
Khrushchev had finally won full power after the struggle inside the Politburo in 1957 against the so-called anti-party group. And he had made a number of speeches, in effect, to indicate that the Soviet Union had to be taken seriously on a new basis. And Khrushchev, very eager to demonstrate that he could do that. So the result of it is the pressing of the Berlin question in 1959, and then again in 1961, and then finally the Cuban Missile Crisis.
Of the three leaders, Castro was the most unpredictable of all, also the weakest of all. And as the weakest, he felt that he had to be absolutely uncompromising in standing up to the Americans. And of the three of them, it was Castro who was most prepared to fight what would have been a nuclear war, even though he knew that his island would be destroyed in the process. And that was the message that he transmitted to his own people, but it was also the message he transmitted to the leaders of the Soviet Union and the United States, both of whom ended up thinking that he was a bit of a wild card who had to be controlled.
Controlling Castro was a risk that Khrushchev was prepared to take. From 1959 on, the US had been deploying missiles in Europe that directly threatened the Soviet Union. Cuba offered Khrushchev a chance to redress the balance.
Khrushchev tells us he went to the seashore and he looked across the Black Sea and saw the American IRBMs. These are intermediate range missiles, a couple of thousand miles range, that could hit the Soviet Union and that we were highly vulnerable. So this is a very hair-trigger state.
The Americans had stationed missiles around the periphery of the Soviet Union, particularly in Turkey. Short-range nuclear missiles, very similar to the Soviet missiles that were deployed in Cuba. So Khrushchev thought, well, if Kennedy can do this to me, I will do the same to him. It was a tit-for-tat as he saw it.
This is the Jupiter, the IRBM being developed by the Army, which will be capable of delivering a nuclear warhead 1,500 miles.
When the threat of Soviet missiles in Cuba became known, Kennedy urgently convened the Executive Committee of the National Security Council, or EXCOM, to oversee the crisis. Again, as in 1914, there was a real danger of events spiralling out of control, of human miscalculation, of military plans taking on their own momentum.
Surprise does something to world leaders. They move into animal mode thinking, that reptilian part of our brain kicks in first. So the first meetings of EXCOM were really looking at the operational plans that were on the table. And one of them was coming out of the Bay of Pigs fiasco, which was, how do we depose this thorn in our side without another fiasco? Well, you go in strong. You don't go in with a small pinprick. There were attempts to destabilize Castro before this that had failed. Operation Mongoose was the name of the secret plan. Some of it was fairly ludicrous, putting LSD into his food before he did a public speech, or depilatories on his shoe so his beard would fall out. The sides were all in that kind of hyper-vigilant, maybe even paranoid state of mind when the shoe drops, so to speak, and the missiles are discovered. But still, the intelligence was faulty. The U.S. thought that there weren't nuclear warheads yet, but turns out that there were tactical nuclear warheads. The SS-3s and SS-4s were on the way. So if the U.S. had gone in hot, the Soviet general on the ground, who was a World War II field marshal who had a fair amount of independence, most likely would have used tactical nuclear warheads because it would have been his only defense against an invading force. So you would have had a lot of Marines vaporized in any kind of invasion.
The military chiefs at the time, and the most obvious example is Curtis LeMay, who was head of the Air Force and the Strategic Air Command, which controlled all the nuclear missiles. Curtis LeMay was very much a hawk, and he felt that the United States was much stronger than the Soviet Union, that it enjoyed overwhelming nuclear superiority, and this was the time to take out the Russian bear once and for all. And he felt that the Soviets would back down if confronted with the power of the United States. And at one point during the crisis early on, he actually accused Kennedy of appeasement. But although LeMay wanted a military confrontation with the Soviet Union, was prepared to fight a nuclear war, ultimately he obeyed civilian authority. There was no threat of a military coup in the United States. I think a bigger threat to Kennedy was just simply losing control of this military machine. Things were happening all over the world that he couldn't completely control as the commander-in-chief. Nuclear weapons were being put on alert, accidents were possible, there were many things that went wrong during the crisis, and it was impossible for a single person in the White House to control this vast military machine all over the world.
Michael Dobbs. Kennedy sensibly rejected the wilder options put forward by his military staff. Instead, he declared a naval quarantine. Soviet ships carrying missiles would not be allowed to reach Cuba.
I have directed that the following initial steps be taken immediately. To halt this offensive buildup, a strict quarantine on all offensive military equipment under shipment to Cuba is being initiated. All ships of any kind bound for Cuba, from whatever nation or port, will, if found to contain cargoes of offensive weapons, be turned back. It shall be the policy of this nation to regard any nuclear missile launched from Cuba against any nation in the Western Hemisphere as an attack by the Soviet Union on the United States, requiring a full retaliatory response upon the Soviet Union.
The quarantine bought Kennedy time for diplomacy. Messages passed between the two leaders, Khrushchev's becoming increasingly more warlike. Kennedy remained calm. James Dedarian.
There are several moments during the Cuban Missile Crisis where Kennedy made a conscious effort, first by not responding to the second letter, which was much more belligerent, seemed to be written by committee rather than Khrushchev, where Khrushchev was basically speaking to a public audience. It was broadcast, this message, where it was much more tit-for-tat, you get rid of the Jupiter missiles on the borders of Turkey and Russia, and then maybe we'll consider getting rid of our missiles on the border of the United States. And Kennedy ignored that and went with a more diplomatic response of the first letter.
If you read those letters, all of which have now been published, it is remarkable to see. Khrushchev and Kennedy, the stakes are enormous, and yet they are always polite. They never call each other names. They always make certain in those letters to take the other person's point of view into account while still arguing very strongly for their own. This was diplomatically masterful.
A few months earlier, Kennedy had read Barbara Tuchman's The Guns of August. As the Cuban Missile Crisis unfolded, he told his brother Robert that he wouldn't follow a course which would allow anyone to write a comparable book about him. If anyone's around after this, he said, they're going to understand that we made every effort to find peace, and every effort to give our adversary room to move. John Langdon is professor of history at Le Moyne College.
What Kennedy, I think, derived on a more or less subliminal level, because he never actually commented on this, but if you accept the idea that in any particular crisis and conflict, there are multiple levels of causation, then what you're also accepting, it seems to me implicitly, is that there are multiple sets of interests at stake, and that the other side, for example, the Soviets in the Cuban Missile Crisis, they see things in a different way than the United States sees things. Their interests have to be respected, not necessarily agreed with, but they have to be respected if you're going to come to a peaceful settlement. And you have to allow the leadership of the other country to save face, to allow them to say that they did not completely lose. And I think to that extent, Kennedy did all of us a great favor in working with the Soviets the way he did.
Kennedy read the book very early on in 1962, just as this confrontation with his Soviet counterpart was coming to a head. The lesson he drew from it was that you can get into wars without really intending to, without anybody being in control of events. And the big difference, of course, between the First World War and the Cuban Missile Crisis was the nature of the weaponry. The First World War was bad enough, but by 1962 you had nuclear weapons that could literally destroy the world. So the lesson that Kennedy took from Tuchman's book was that if we're going to go to war again, we better have a very good reason for going to war and be able to explain that to our publics and ourselves. And this was not the case in 1914. So he ordered the book to be distributed to American military bases around the world. He told all his aides to read it. And we have also evidence that during the crisis itself, he and his aides referred to the lessons from Barbara Tuchman's book.
What he took from it is the danger of adhering to military timetables. Also, I think, the role that mistakes and misassumptions can play in creating a catastrophe. I think what he'd also learned, and it had been a very bitter lesson, was that the year before, he had presided over the fiasco of the Bay of Pigs. It was a plan he inherited from the previous administration. But I think what Kennedy learned, both from reading, but also from his own very, very painful experience in the Bay of Pigs, was that you don't trust the military on everything. They're there to tell you how to wage war, but you have to, as a civilian, make the final decision.
What he did is he slowed down the decision-making process, so it wasn't just generals or people who had vested interest in there being a military solution. He brought in civilian advisors and Sorensen and Kevin Donnelly and others who were willing to look at the follow-on consequences as opposed to the immediate. And that was very good, because you need, in these circumstances, to build coalitions.
I think quite bravely, in the Cuban Missile Crisis, he overruled. I mean, he'd only been a lieutenant in the Second World War, and here are all these generals, you know, in command of the Air Force, in command of the Navy, in the command of the Army, medals everywhere, gold braid everywhere, and he stood up to them and said, I'm not doing what you advise. And I think it was a very brave decision. I think Barbara Tuchman's book probably helped in that, but I think so did his experience with the Bay of Pigs.
The crisis reached its peak on Saturday, October 27th, 1962. Black Saturday.
We were already in the early stages of a nuclear war. The Soviets were moving their nuclear warheads up to the missile sites. They were preparing an attack on the U.S. naval base at Guantanamo. American planes were being put on alert. There were attempts by the U.S. Navy to surface Soviet submarines in the Caribbean, which turned out later, were carrying nuclear torpedoes. So all along this Cold War battlefront, forces were on trigger alert. And on this day, an American U-2 spy plane was shot down over Cuba by Soviet forces without authorization from Moscow. And most extraordinarily, perhaps, another American U-2 was lost on a routine mission to the North Pole, took a wrong turn at the North Pole, and ended up over the Eastern Soviet Union on the most dangerous day of the Cold War. Khrushchev later said that plane could have been mistaken for the first wave of a nuclear strike and led to catastrophic consequences. And it was also that day that both Khrushchev and Kennedy, in their different ways, understood that events were spinning out of control, and they both moved to bring the crisis to an end. Khrushchev sent a message by radio, actually, to Kennedy, saying he was prepared to do a swap. He would swap his missiles in Cuba for American intermediate-range missiles in Turkey. And all of the president's advisors were against the idea of an exchange. The only one in the room who thought that this might be a way of resolving the crisis was Kennedy himself. And Bobby Kennedy said, well, if it was done in secret, we would be able to agree to that. But the condition would be that it would never be publicly revealed. This message was transmitted back to Khrushchev, who, for reasons of his own, also felt that he was losing control of events. And by this point, he felt that if the crisis continued any further, it could well end up in some kind of nuclear exchange.
You need people on both sides who are willing to talk to each other. And I think we tend to look at what Kennedy did in 62 and forget what Khrushchev did. And Khrushchev was every bit as important, because if Kennedy had been dealing with someone else in Moscow, it would have made no difference at all. But Khrushchev took a terrific risk and, of course, was eased out of power very shortly thereafter, I think partly as a result of taking that risk. But he took a terrific risk, and he was prepared for the sake, as he said, of future generations to back down.
He decided at that point that the wisest course of action was to announce the immediate withdrawal of Soviet missiles in Cuba, which he did the following day, October the 28th, by radio, which brought the immediate crisis to an end. But there was the understanding that American missiles in Turkey would be withdrawn within a few weeks, which indeed was what happened in secret.
And so the world pulled back from the very brink of nuclear war, thanks to Kennedy's brilliance as a statesman, and in part to his reading of The Guns of August. But is it possible that Kennedy misread the book, or read more into it than was there on the page? John Langdon.
Kennedy was a very voracious reader. He didn't always get his facts straight. He seemed to believe that Tuchman had argued that no country was primarily responsible for the outbreak of war, that every country was more or less equally responsible, and that war began, in a sense, in a fit of absence of mind. It began by accident. This is not what Tuchman said. It's essentially what Sidney Fay said in 1930. A number of revisionist historians had argued along those lines. And it is true that Kennedy put these ideas to work in his handling of the Cuban Missile Crisis, but to attribute them to Barbara Tuchman is unfortunately mistaken.
He made a certain interpolation there. He filled in some of the blanks and put it together in his mind with some of the other literature which he knew about that had to do with the causes of the war and that stressed the role of accident. And he was very impressed by her sort of putting icing on the cake of that thesis of accident. Strictly speaking, it's military history what she's talking about. But the diplomatic side of it is sort of indicated. Some people have taken the view that JFK was wrong to interpret it that way. That is to say, to include the diplomatic side of the argument for accident along with Tuchman's argument about the mistakes of the short war. But I don't think that's wrong. That makes perfect sense to me for Kennedy to have associated those two ideas, especially in terms of the strategic ideas of the time in which he lived.
But whether Kennedy misread Tuchman's book or not, it's clear that he was determined not to repeat the diplomatic failings of 1914. In the end, what's important were the lessons that he took from history, and in turn what this tells us about how our political and military leaders can learn from the mistakes of the past.
I think Kennedy, one of his qualities as a political leader was he actually had a deep understanding of history, quite a sophisticated and nuanced understanding. And I think you have to have a sophisticated rather than simplistic understanding of history in order to draw the correct lessons.
History, in a sense, doesn't really teach us anything. History is the record of the past, and it's an inanimate object. But we can learn from it. It depends on the degree of openness that we bring to the study of history. It depends upon the degree of flexibility of our mental faculties that we bring to things like diplomatic documents, memoirs, interviews, and the context, the cultural and social and economic contexts that were operating in those days. To a large extent, even though it was 100 years ago, the 20th century has been long and blood-filled, but it has also been extremely short in the sense that many of the problems that we've faced in the 20th century and the early part of the 21st, we could easily see facing again. In the next great crisis that comes along, how open-minded will we be? How flexible will we be?
On Hindsight on RN, you've been listening to The Guns of August. The program was produced and presented by Gary Bryson, with technical production by Louis Mitchell. Readings from Barbara Tuchman's book, The Guns of August, were by Jeanette Cronin. As always, you'll find much more information at our website, abc.net.au/radionational, and look for Hindsight in the drop-down box. Leave us a comment too, we always love to hear from you. I'm Lorena Allam, thanks for your company today.